Dear listeners, welcome to the Public Perception of Science podcast.
My name is Lieven Heremans.
And mine is Bram Harkema.
As you might know, the role of academic research in society is undergoing some serious discussions at the moment. For us as students, this discussion was actualized by last year's Maagdenhuis appropriation in Amsterdam. We feel the need to investigate and reflect academically upon the public perception of science and academia. Therefore, we set up this lecture series at Utrecht University in early 2016.
The guest lectures you will hear in this series come from different Dutch universities and have different disciplinary backgrounds. All speakers have in some way attributed to this discussion.
In this fifth and last lecture, you will hear Hans Radder, Emeritus Professor of Philosophy of Science and Technology at the Free or VU University in Amsterdam. He will put forward an analysis of the commodification of science and the university in this lecture. Once again, you can find the slideshow and other interesting material via the link in the podcast description.
Thank you very much, and thanks the organizers for inviting me here. I will speak about, the title of my talk is The Present University and Its Future. And so I will use the slides for that, and maybe if there is some more time left, then I can also say a little bit about the future of the university from a more, say, the practical and political point of view, and also how about our interactions, say, with public media and so on. Yeah. Just contents. What's the good of science? So what's the good of science? And so, also given the topic of your lecture series, what's the good of science according to the public perception? What is being valued in science and what not? So I will discuss four issues. So secondly, what's the good of science from a philosophy of science approach? So that's more an academic view of the good of science, but I will discuss that only briefly. Section 3, that's what the focus of my talk is today. So what's the good of university science? So then somewhat more specific question, and here I will provide a philosophical analysis of its current social legitimations. And these legitimations, they play a role in the public perception of science. And so section 3 is rather critical of the current perception and dominant perception of science. But in section 4, I will provide also some elements of an alternative vision. First, a problem. Science, of course, is an English term, but I will use science in the European sense of wetenschap, wissenschaft, science, whatever language you have. And that means that it includes not just, say, the natural and the life sciences, and maybe parts of the social sciences, but fully the social sciences, the humanities, the formal sciences, and so on. Okay, so that about that. And then the question, what's the good of science? I think that question asks for the aim or the aims of science. So why are we doing science? And so that's already you can already start discussing this, and can already be quite a complex issue. But I will discuss this question of the aim or aims by looking at the answers to the question of the value of science. So how is science valued? And as I said, briefly by academic philosophers of science, and much more extensively, say, by society and so by social actors. Huh? Okay. Wait a minute, let me see. Let me just do it this way. Yeah. The philosophy of science approach. Well, parts of you are in history and philosophy of science, but others are in media studies, so somewhat different. So this will be very brief. So the philosophers have proposed a variety and even a diversity of aims for science. So one very traditional is science aims to find truth, the truth. And then people say, well, no. There are empiricists. They say, no, you cannot find the truth about, say, unobservable things. So we have to be more moderate, more modest. So finding the truth about of statements about the observable world, the most famous philosopher of science here is now Bas van Fraassen. Or they say, well, no, that's truth is difficult, but explanation. The aim of science is to find explanations of observable phenomena, observable events. Or the fourth, even a bit more modest, saying, no, we don't want to be involved in tricky philosophical things about what is explanation, what is truth, what is reality, solving empirical and conceptual problems. What you see from this is that most philosophy of science is internalist in the sense that it focuses on the scientists and their direct environment, the scientist in their laboratories, the scientist in their journals, in their knowledge claims, and so on. So then traditional philosophy of science, or I think even today dominant philosophy of science, focuses on the knowledge and the methods, and then even primarily on basic science and less on applied science, or however you want to call this, although I should say that recently there is more more attention also to applied science. But in this traditional approach, there is not much attention or little attention given to the socio-cultural embedding of the sciences. The socio-cultural environment of the sciences, how is science viewed from there? And so in a way, these are, as economists say, externalities only. They are externalities only. So, I think, certainly given the topic of your lecture series, it's good to leave this philosophy of science, this traditional approach at least, to leave that behind and focus, some other characterizations of the value of science. In a way, this is a more empirical characterization of three characteristics of the current universities. And these characteristics have to do with how people, say, value science. I've coined these three terms here, hierarchization. And so this means that the university is an ordinary enterprise, and efficiency is or should be one of its prime values. And this means that university governance should be top-down hierarchical. Maybe we could already note here, it's not necessary if you think that somebody is an ordinary enterprise that the organization is hierarchical. But this is the dominant way of thinking these days, and maybe has ever been, but it's not necessary. So that's important. And what it means is that, most of you are students, but if you have worked for a number of years, or like me, for decades on the shop floor of the university, then you have seen that in the course of these decades, professors, university lecturers, support staff, and so on, they have increasingly smaller voice in what to do in their own work, in the organization of their work, and so on. I think it's quite easy to claim that, and I think it's very plausible. And this is also could be a very interesting research subject. If you look at Dutch universities, and say you look at their organization and how they were governed, say, since the 1970s, from this perspective, then you see it's quite clear this hierarchization has increased and increased. Maybe with some qualifications, maybe very recently some small qualifications, and of course there can be differences between universities. So it's never all or nothing. Fully hierarchical, there are always some qualifications to make. But as a pattern, as a trend, I think it's it applies. Okay, this is here. Yeah. So the second characteristic is bureaucratization. And so this is a difficult concept, I think, and there is a lot of social science theorizing about what is bureaucracy and how to understand it and so on. But I will here limit myself just to two characteristics of the bureaucratized universities. And the first is that what has arisen is a separate layer of administrators or managers and their support staff. For instance, when I started at the VU University, I think in my faculty there was just one office, one room where all the support staff was. Could be located there, I think, two or three people. Now, when I left, I think 30% of all the offices were taken by managers, administrative support staff, and so on. So that has really been a very obvious development. And the problem is that what arose also was an ever widening gap between administrators and managers on the one hand and the shop floor on the other. So often this gap could also be seen in a spatial sense that, for instance, at some point the College van Bestuur of the VU, so the executive board, they moved to another location 5 kilometers further on. And it's only recently when all these debates in the Netherlands started, so 2 years ago, that they thought, oh, maybe this is not a good idea, so they moved back. The second characteristic here is also very important. So what this separate layer of administrators, managers, from, say, the people who do the science and are supporting the science, that also entails a formalization of the interactions between administrators, managers, and the shop floor. So in the sense that analyzing, assessing what is happening in the university, evaluating the results of teaching, of research, that is now being done increasingly in a formalized way, and I call this in a content-less way. So along criteria that are content-less criteria. Let me content-less criteria, they are primarily focused on the form and not on the content. For instance, if you count citations, then you don't know whether a certain book or article was cited as an example of a very bad approach. No, just one citation. Also, you don't know whether this is a citation one among 20 in a totally unimportant footnote, or whether it's a citation of something that was discussed for 10 pages. You don't know this. So this is what I mean with content-less. Also in teaching, you also have all kinds of content-less criteria. If your only criterion is whether students pass their final exam, then okay, that doesn't tell you how much have they learned. How much have they learned? And so the idea of content-less criteria is that these criteria, they are compatible with a whole variety of more substantive content. So that's the point. It doesn't mean I don't want to say with contentless that they are meaningless. Huh? That's not the case. I mean, me too. It's nice to be cited. If you're cited, at least there is something is done with your work. If nobody ever does cites it, okay, it could still be that it's being used, but it's a sign of being used. So it's not that it's meaningless, but it's a rather specific way of assessing. Okay. Yeah. So there are a few implications. There are many more, but in this I can only speak about a few things here. So one is that the contentless policies, they tend to erase important distinctions between disciplines. Also because, the administration is centralized in the university and it's top-down. And so it's a tendency. It's not that it's an absolute erasion of these distinctions, but it's a tendency. So, for instance, the good thing is we are here in the humanities or social sciences, probably media studies. Does that count as social science, I think? So,
It's humanities?
Okay. But there is a...
There are some elements which have been described to social sciences,
yes.
But
yeah.
The overarching
yeah.
Elements
yeah.
From...
Yeah, okay, good. So what you will notice, and certainly when you will start working in a university yourself, maybe doing a PhD, what counts these days is journal publications. Journal publications. And in the natural sciences, in the life sciences, and in some parts of the social sciences and psychology, this is, the practice. Huh? So in the natural sciences, writing a book, that doesn't count. Huh? That doesn't count. There are, and then also humanities and social scientists, they took over this policy. And a famous or an infamous example is from somebody... from Groningen in theoretical psychology, and she wrote a book, published a book of 400 pages with Cambridge University Press, and in the results of the Faculty of Psychology in Groningen, this didn't count at all. She wasn't even allowed to mention it. So this is one of your former speakers. Now maybe you have a clue who that is. Yeah. So that's. Okay, and then the question is, can this preference be justified for the humanities and a part of the social sciences? And so the answer is really no. And so I did a small empirical study here. I looked at four journal issues in these disciplines. And from 2012, and here I had... more than 1,000 references, and so the references to books and book chapters, that was 48%, 49 almost. So that means that is not negligible. It's certainly not negligible. And so in philosophy, it was even somewhat higher than in social science journals. So of course you can do this kind of study in a more precise way. But I think this is okay. This result is okay as in terms of the order of magnitude, as physicists used to say. The order of magnitude, that's okay. Even if it would be, 42% or 52, it's still the case that a substantial, very substantial part of the publications are still books and books chapters. Okay, so that's a second implication of these content-less policies. So they strongly value formal quality indicators, such as the journal impact factor. I don't know, have some of you heard about this? Maybe if you read about science occasionally, huh? So here the journal impact factor, for instance, for the year 2014 is defined here, huh, as the average numbers of times articles from 2012 and 2013 volumes have been cited in the year 2014. Huh? So for instance, you have a journal, and in the years 2012 and 13, there are 100 articles. Huh? And half of them are cited twice in 2014, and half of them are cited four times. Huh? Then the journal impact factor is 3. So that... Now, it is the case that scientists, that they find this very important, and science policy makers find it very important. And if you apply for research money, it's very important to have published in journals with a high journal impact factor. I've experienced this myself, that they said, yeah, he published in that journal, but that journal has a very low impact factor. Okay, that would be okay if this journal impact factor, it's also contentless, but if it makes sense. Huh? And here my claim is even about stronger. I would say this is not just a contentless criterion, it's a pseudo-scientific criterion. Huh? And so there are two problems. Huh? There are more problems, but these two. Huh? The first thing is that... as you see from the definition, this journal impact factor only measures the short-term impact over 2 years. And in the paper I've analyzed that even in more detail, and there are other factors that make this far less than two years. That doesn't work. That doesn't mean it doesn't tell us much about the long-term significance of the articles. The thing is that... if you are going to look at, if you look back at the citation pattern, for instance, from 2014, then you can see that in many, many journals in the social sciences and humanities, the age of the average article that is cited is 10 years. So that means that there is already a span of 10 years, and it means that the oldest articles, they go back 20 years. Well, there are a few older, if you cite Aristotle and so on. But 20 years is quite common. So that means that the span, say the possible impact of articles, certainly in the humanities and social sciences, is much longer than 2 years. Then you could say, well, that may be fine, but maybe the two-year journal impact factor is a good predictor also of the long term. That could be the case. Huh? That could be the case that it's enough just that those 2 years that they predict also the impact, in 5 years or so. Well, this is not the case because you also have the 5-year journal impact factor that is less common. And if you look at the relationship between the 2-year and the 5-year, you can see quantitatively, in terms of figures, that they differ a lot. That the ranking of the journals on the basis of the 2-year journal impact factor differs substantially from the ranking of the journals according to the 5-year journal impact factor. So... that's really a big problem. It's a big problem. There is another problem, that the distribution of cited articles is strongly skewed. Huh? A few are highly cited, the rest far less or not at all. Huh? So, for instance, I don't have the exact figures here, but I think it's something like that 10% of the articles... for instance, in 2012 and 13, they acquire, say, 80 or 90% of the citations. So this means that the resulting impact factor, okay, is mostly due, by far, to only a very small part of the articles in the journal. And this means that you cannot use the journal impact factor in evaluating individual articles. Because, okay, these 90%, they are hardly cited at all. Huh? Yet, this happens very often. So professional scientometricians, they they warn against using such measures like the journal impact factor for individual scientists, but in fact it happens all the time. It happens all the time in assessments. Okay. So that's far about the bureaucratization. And I think here, so my views and the views also the platform happened new, they agree a lot with, for instance, science in transition. And also with probably with what Frank Miedema has told here about science in transition has focused a lot on the publication culture. And has also been successful in that some changes have been achieved there. So now the next and the third characteristics, commodification or economization of science. I think here I do not read that much in Science in Transition about this third major characteristic. So here, academic commodification, so it means commodification of at the university level or other academic institutions. It means that all kinds of scientific activities and the results are predominantly interpreted and assessed on the basis of economic or financial criteria. So you see that differs from this bureaucratization. I mean, this journal impact factor is not immediately related to money. It can be de facto related to opportunities for acquiring money, but it's not immediately clear, and certainly conceptually it's different. So commodification is from the idea of a commodity. Commodification means that activities and maybe also objects that were at first or initially not measured in terms of money are now being measured in terms of money. For instance, if you are going to measure, say, in terms of money, the characteristics of the environment, you say, well, a less polluted environment and a more polluted environment, that means, say, a financial damage of so many million euros. So that's a commodification. Okay, so here some on the A and further some clarification. So it includes commercialization, but it's broader than commercialization. For instance, you can also have what is called internal commodification, that if a university pays, so if the central university board pays, say, the faculties on the basis of output, for instance, on the basis of the credits achieved, what is very common these days, and that's what you call also a commodification. So at the Free University, I think there was a difference also between disciplines. I think we in philosophy and the humanities, we got 60 euro for one credit. So if you pass an exam of 4 credits, or so, we got 240 euros. And the natural and life sciences, they got 90 euros. And okay, clearly academic commodification is part of a comprehensive sociocultural development.
So to what extent is this related or overlaps with financialization, like these sort of more contingent factors?
That's a good question. I think it depends, of course, on how you define these terms, but at least, say, as far as I know from the discussions at the University of Amsterdam, that financialization is a bit different because it had to do, at least the focus of that is on, say, the money spent on buildings and real estate and so on. And so if that is the core of financialization, then there is not that is not what you call commodification. It's, I mean, these buildings always had a price, and so they were already in the market, in the financial market. So commodification is really if there is a change from substantive characteristics of quality to monetary characteristics. That is, in the Marxian terms, from use value to exchange value. Huh?
And if you were to make a timeline, would you say these are part of the same sort of sociocultural formation, for instance? And could you maybe specify a bit more this development in that sense? Like, I'm very interested in these interactions in a certain way. Because I think they are different processes, I understand it, but I'm also, in a historical sense, I'm not sure where to
reach. I think, if you think about the Dutch situation, then this had a lot to do with, in 1995, when the universities, they suddenly got a present, namely the proud owners of their buildings. But there was a small problem with this present, that there was no money, or not enough money, provided for maintaining these buildings. So in a way, of course, there were always, every university and even departments, they had people that dealing with, the buildings and the material infrastructure. But here in the Netherlands, this has been a very important change in this respect. I think, and so here it's interesting to relate this to what I said about the hierarchization, and so this study that I recommended to do in the Netherlands from the 1970s until now, then it could be that there are relations between, this gap between administration and measurement and managers on the one hand, and this financialization. Certainly at the VU, for instance, it was... do you know the concept of the Zuidas in Amsterdam? So the Zuidas is they built a kind of Manhattan-like towers and so on. And the VU was just at the other side. Okay, here you had the Zuidas, but here was a road, and we were just here. So we were not fully the Zuidas. And so the former executive board, they were extremely keen... We wanted to be the Zuidas. We wanted to be there. And they even had some plans to move the main building of 16 floors to the other side of the street. Because then we would be on the Zuidas. it's very interesting. And it's a very interesting topic also.
And a vivid image of these.
And you could also do discourse analysis here. Now, in... documents of my university, the word Zuidas, I'm sure it's almost absent. It would be interesting to see when that happened. It happened, I think, around the financial crisis. Then when they saw, maybe the Zuidas, maybe it's not so good to be constantly associated with that. But a very interesting project, yeah. So I leave out science outside of academia. Of course, there is a lot of science that is done in industrial laboratories or in commercial settings, has always been done. So that they are commodified, that's natural. It doesn't mean that you couldn't look at this and investigate it, but here I leave out. And also my focus here is on academic research. You could also look at the commodification of teaching and also of administration. For instance, in administration, all these outsourcing, the people who are constantly hired from outside the university to be an interim manager or to advise for some problem. So here I have a few questions. I think they are also in the introduction in this book, which I recommended in the literature. Which forms of commodification can be distinguished? There are various forms. Sometimes they are specific for specific countries, or they are more pronounced in some countries than in others. For instance, contract research by a commercial external organization, that's what you find everywhere. That's what you find in all countries. Think, for instance, here the major example is, of course, the pharmaceutical industry and, say, medical research. But it's also in computer science and maybe even in some social sciences, for instance, social sciences who are doing advisory work for, say, for governments or governmental bodies. That can be everywhere. Yeah. Yeah, you see, so there are here, of course, there are the big issues, say big pharma. There is a lot of literature about big pharma, and also in the book here, there are quite a few chapters by Jim Brown, by David Resnick, by Bert Mussinga. They focus on medicine, but these are the dramatic, and there you find the dramatic problems of full corruption and so on. But the first chapter here by Daniel Kleinman, he says, well, that's true, we need to study those as well, but what is very important also to look at, the smaller changes in the academic culture. The smaller changes in the that are not so dramatic, but that can be pervasive, can be very pervasive. And I think that he is right there. Let me tell you this. I was in the year 2002. I was at the Wageningen University, then called Agricultural University. This was a workshop on ethics in science. We talked about all kinds of things, and informally I talked to a PhD student who had this contract research, and he said, yes, we had a good, I have a good relationship with the industry who funds my research, and there is a clear agreement, it's transparent. So this is then always the panacea from from the science policy people. It should be transparent. It was transparent. But there was a small problem, namely that he could publish about his research, freely publish, but in these publications he was not allowed to mention which crop his research focused on. So it was in Wageningen, so there was a certain crop, I don't know, whatever it was, beetroot or wheat. He wasn't allowed to mention that. This is not so dramatic as you see in big pharma who cheats, say, with their research about drugs that then are very dangerous and then cost lives. But this is not optimal science. If you see a publication, you want to know which crop is it. So it's important also to look at that and to see transparency doesn't help here. It was transparent. But transparency is only, as I say, it makes the problem visible, but it doesn't solve the problem. Yeah. Okay. In the Netherlands, especially, we have these special professorships. Maybe you read the ones of you who read Dutch. The professor van WC Eend is very famous here as a kind of term. That will, I think, in the humanities, it's far less usual. But if you go to Eindhoven Technical University, there will be a lot of people, who work with Philips, and one day in the week they teach and they do research. So then the question is, what about their independence? Patenting practices of public universities. I will say more later on about that, although I also have to look at the time. That has increased a lot in the past 35 years. So let me mention this. This commodification, often the year 1980 is taken to be a very important year. Because then in the United States, a law was passed where federal funded research could be patented. But okay, 1980, you shouldn't take that too seriously, but just to make up your mind. But for instance, in this is also the media studies, and the HPS people don't have many patents. But we're talking about science more broadly, and so between 1980 and 1984, the Wageningen University, they had two patents. And between 2005 and 2009, they had 47. There's a big increase. The Rathenau Institute, have you heard about the Rathenau Institute? It's relevant for your topic, I think. They had a good paper about it, Feiten and Cijfers, and it's very very illuminating. Okay, hierarchical corporate structure of university administration, I have already mentioned that. And then also prevalence of economic vocabularies and assessment procedures. So in a way, of course, there are relations between these three characteristics. So hierarchization, bureaucratization, and economization, and commodification. But they are also, they certainly are conceptually different. And if they are related, that's not necessary. I think in the 1950s, in many countries, and certainly in the Netherlands, we had also a very hierarchical university, but there was not much commodification then. So that's important to keep that in mind. Okay, let's move on with this. Yeah, what is very important these days, so I'm still talking about commodification, the role of brought-in research money. So these days it's often included in research contracts. So if you will finish your study and you are going to apply for an UD, so an universitaire docent, it could be that in your contract is already that you're supposed to acquire on average per year, say, 50,000. For 50,000 euros. And if you move on in your career and you will become a professor, then that could rise to 250,000 a year or something like that. That is now quite normal. That's quite normal. Also, not just when you start a job, but also for promotion. So there was somebody in the University of Amsterdam who was an UD, so often translated with assistant professor or university lecturer, and he really qualified for an UHD, so a principal lecturer of associate professor. And so he was fine in terms of his teaching, his research, his work in committees and so on, that was all evaluated very well. So he went to see the dean, and then the dean said, yes, that's all fine, but there is one problem. That is brought in money. You haven't acquired enough brought in money. And this was within a specific number of years, 800,000 euros. And he hadn't done that. So this is what you call commodification. There is much more to be said about this example, because I think you can argue that the people who have brought in this money and the people who haven't are not necessarily, that the latter are not necessarily less in a scientific way. But okay, I think we don't have time to do that. And also the third bullet here, I don't know how it is with the Utrecht University magazine, but the Free University magazine has always 1.5 million for Project X. So it starts with the money. And okay, if you're lucky, they say also a little bit about the research. So this is the primacy, the priority is in terms of PR. Okay, academic patenting practices. So patenting, that is a patent is a commercial monopoly. If you acquire a patent, for instance, on a certain medical invention, then you are allowed to commercially exploit this, and others are not allowed. And if others still do that, try to copy it or so, then you can sue them in a legal way. Huh? So it's a commercial monopoly. Huh? Now this is a bit of a sideline. Compare this to open access. I'm sure you have followed these discussions in the Netherlands and elsewhere about open access. And here, politicians and the National Research Council, NBO, and everybody says open access, yes, yes, yes. And here I have a quotation. NBO agrees that research results obtained with public money should be publicly available as much as possible. In this way, valuable knowledge can be used by researchers, company, and social organizations. So this looks like a general principle. But you think, okay, that's very nice that they hold this general principle. But then my question is, if that's the case, why does the same NBO constantly say, urge people to cooperate with industry and so on, and also to promote patenting as a very important part of the cooperation? Because patenting explicitly and immediately goes against this italicized sentence here. If an invention is patented, then it cannot be used by researchers, companies, and social organizations, at least not be used freely. Okay. Yeah, so this was somewhat, which forms of communication can be distinguished. Huh? So there are a lot of further questions. I will be quicker about these. How widespread and novel is the phenomenon of academic communication? So as I already said, we should not be naive and think that it's an all or nothing thing. Okay, in the past it was fine, we were in paradise and so on, and now it's all bad. No, there can be a lot of differences. Huh? Here I speak, it's a kind of pattern, and you have to do empirical research to see how significant it is. Huh? For instance, in different countries, for different periods, for different disciplines, and so on. Differentiation. And then also for different forms of communications, types of institutions. Okay, historical periods, yeah. Okay, but when you study things to a certain depth, and you I think you can claim these days, and this is what I do in the introduction of the book here, that current academic communication is a substantial and significant phenomenon. Okay. If that's the case, then there is the question C. That is on the next one. Yeah. How to assess the commodification of academic research? Huh? So, there is also much more to be said than just these terms I write down. It can be philosophical. Huh? For instance, you can ask the kind of knowledge you get, is it as good in a non-commodified science as in a commodified science. It can be political in the sense of science policy and the politics of science. So what does commodification do for the progress of science, and what does non-commodified science do? It can also be moral in the sense that you, for instance, about this patenting, there have been a lot of debates about the patenting of life forms or parts of living organisms. This is totally common now, but there have been a lot of debates about this. Okay, but here I will not. I will not say more here. So let's go. So this assessment, say some more general thing about the assessment of this commodification. And so there are some things that we have to avoid negatively, and the next slide positively. So there are also some pitfalls, what I call pitfalls of the critique of academic commodification. And so one is unjustly generalized personal experience. It says, I must say I do see those, well, occasionally or maybe even more often among philosophers. Huh? So what you need to be aware that different disciplines can be different. Different disciplines have been different, and the situation in different disciplines is really, really varying. Huh? So I think here I can profit a little bit that I also started my career as a physicist, and so I try to look also what does it mean for different disciplines. So. Lack of serious scholarship, yeah, that is also what you often see. For instance, one thing is that critics sometimes say, well, what you see is the patenting of knowledge. Huh? But knowledge cannot be patented. The aim of the patent system is just that knowledge should not be patented. What you can patent is specific uses of that knowledge. But the knowledge, you have to make that public. And so other people can do other things with that knowledge. Huh? So that's... But you often see this, I think, patenting knowledge, that, yeah. Okay, inflated, inadequate accounts of science and academic institutions, for instance, notions of academic freedom, yes. Or sometimes, say, the idea that in the past everything was very good and no problems at all, and... So that we have to be careful for that, because, for instance, there are people who say academic freedom. If you look at science in the U.S. After the Second World War, there was academic freedom. I think 45% of the basic research was paid by the military. So was that academic freedom? Well, not really. So that's also a pitfall to avoid. On the other hand, criticism of current science don't have to rely on a paradise in the past. That's not needed at all. Huh? So you don't have to rely on that. Okay, the last is very important: rejection of requests for the social legitimation of science. I think also so in our platform happened now. I'm sure among the people who support us, there are two groups. There is one group who says, all these the society, they constantly interfere with science, and just give us our money and you don't hear from us. Just give us. You see? So they reject the request for the social legitimation of science. And I think that is not a good thing. Argument is a bit crude and you can refine it, but so the taxpayer, they have a right to know what is being done with the money. That is the simple thing, and so I will come back to that later on. This is not meant to as a criticism of fundamental science or basic science. So positively, but this is just one thing I tried out myself. So how can we specify critiques of academic commodification and come to more clear conclusions? So what I've done here is I used widely accepted codes of ethical conduct. So for instance, the Dutch, there is the Dutch, they have the KNW and NBO and so on. They have this... How is it called? Something for codification for scientific conduct. Huh? And what you can do is you can use it not just in assessing individual behavior. That is what almost always happens. Huh? For instance, if you talk about fraud or misconduct, that's always that just you are doing something wrong. Huh? And we should also do that. I'm sure we should do that. But what is also very important is to see what are the impacts of structural science policies. Are not scientists sometimes forced to go against these ethical conducts. And I think they are. And one case in which they are forced is, say, if they engage in patenting practices, which are totally legitimized by science policy, by the universities, and so on. So, and that is a complicated argument. So here I have used Robert Merton's ethos of science, with his well-known form norms, universalism, communalism, disinterestedness, and what's the other? Organized skepticism. And okay, I will not go through these steps. It takes too much time, I think. But you can argue that in the case of patents, you can satisfy these Mertonian norms to a far lesser degree than without the patents. So it's not an absolute absolute violence, but it's a matter of degree. It's a matter of degree. For instance, the third one, scientists should not have a direct commercial interest in a specific outcome of their research. Well, in the case of patents, scientists do have this, because they want to acquire this patent, and this patent is a commercial monopoly. So their aim is to have this commercial monopoly. And so they will try to argue in such a way that their application to the patent office makes the chances for approving are as good as possible. Okay, so my conclusion here is concerning commodified academic science. It has many negative implications, partly epistemic, partly social, and partly moral. The overall conclusion about our current universities, so then taking into account the three characteristics, hierarchization, bureaucratization, and commodification, so they are significant and problematic. So one thing, this is then a remark also about the public perception of the current debates. So what you see, and it irritates me enormously, that politicians and policy makers, what they want to do is that the current debate, they say, well, it's a few students. It's not just a few students, it's a few students in Amsterdam. Not a few students in Amsterdam, it's a few students in the Maagdenhuis. This is really belittling and also totally misinterpreting the current arguments. So if you look at the current situation and see, say, about the last 10 years, there has been an enormous amount of scholarly debate, of thorough, in-depth scholarly studies of the universities, the role of science at the moment. In the Netherlands, in the newspapers, it would be interesting to study for you. So when I started studying this, it was, I think, in 1997. Okay, there was not much. Interest in. In 2001, I organized a Studium Generale, so a kind of general lecture series at the VU, under the title Science and Commerce. It was a failure. It was a total failure. It was very difficult to get good speakers. And say the audience that was really far below what we had in other programs at the Studium Generale. So that was 2001. If you then would go further on until now, if you would look at, say, academic publications, go to Amazon and you type in a few related words. If you would do real search in the Dutch media, say the opinion articles and so on, then you will see an enormous increase, gradually, but an enormous increase. And that's not mere students. I mean, I don't want to say anything against students being active, of course, but the reduction of this to students, and especially in the Dutch parliament, that is really, it's unbelievable. That is unbelievable. So here, among the many other books, well, you have read this, but for instance, is Derek Bok. He is a former president of Harvard University, and he writes in 2003 a very critical, a devastating critique of American universities. Huh? So he was not an outsider, he was somebody who had been inside universities in the market. Our book is from 2010, and it has some, I don't know, 13 chapters or so, or 14, by people also from different countries. Huh? Also, I think, scholarly articles, and so based on arguments. And of course, you can, humans can be disputed and debated, that's fine. That's fine, but it's not just mere opinions. And, well, for the Netherlands here, Rudolf Dekker had Excellency Traject, for the people who read Dutch. It's a small book, but it nicely summarizes all different issues, all different areas where the debate has been carried on. Okay. Yeah, so what's the good of university science? Elements of an alternative vision. So, okay, with platform happened nu, maybe did some of you notice the automatic university slogan generator? Okay, so on our website, this was Willem Halfman, he's one of my colleagues, and so we had a certain, earlier we had a certain political action, and this then has to do with how we try to influence the public perception of science and of the organization of the university. So the first part of this action was that we had an, there was a kind of election for the worst university slogan. These days, I said universities are normal corporates, and the norm of firms, enterprises, and so then they need a kind of slogan. They need a kind of slogan, and this is one maybe somewhat smaller part of the current organization of the university, but it's a tip of the iceberg, because underneath there are huge amounts of money that go to communication and corporate communication and so on and so on. And so we had this, and quite a few people, more than 3,000, they voted for, and I think Groningen won with born leaders or born scientists, reach for infinity. And that, but okay, that attracted a lot of interest. But then Willem said, well, yeah, people sometimes criticize us because they say, well, you're only negative and you only have criticism, but come up with something positive. So then he designed the automatic university slogan generator. And so it's a kind of procedure, and it's easy, and you can easily generate for free. Huh? So we offer this for free to all universities.
Business they, mistake, I think. You.
perfect slogans, huh? Perfect slogans. So if you're interested, you can see that on the website. Huh? So that was in a positive spirit. Here, also in a positive spirit, and that's also good because. Yeah, I think the people who have criticism, and I'm also critical, it's not because we don't like university work. It's not because we don't like academic work. It's because we like it. Huh? If that wasn't the case, I wouldn't be here anymore. I would have skipped long ago and, I don't know, maybe done something in the ICT or whatever, huh? So that's the other side of the coin, is that the critics, they really care for their work, huh? And they want to improve that. So that's important to keep that in mind. Huh? And so here, there are a few conditions for that I suggest here for improvement, elements of an alternative vision. In articles I have developed that a bit here, it should be rather short, huh? So the first thing is from hierarchy to having a voice, huh? To having a voice and having a voice and a vote, huh? So permanent and temporary scientists, students and support staff have the right to deliberate and decide on all matters that significantly affect them and about which they are knowledgeable. I think it's very important here. The current debate is in terms of medezeggenschap. It's hard to know what that's in English. Huh? So that is the medezeggenschap. But these councils, the university council, and sometimes you have faculty councils in universities. Not always, by the way. They are at a very high level, at the university level, or at the faculty level, which is also a huge unit, huh? And, okay, we do need that. But I think the basis for having a voice should be at a lower level. And so I think, say, if you think of a university that has units of, say, between 50 and 100 people, then it's neither too small nor too large. And there you can talk about things that really affect you, and you can see how it affects you. And so... If that's the basic level at which, say, having a voice and a vote is located, then maybe, or probably, so this is my my hypothesis, you will also attract more people to be active in these deliberations and votings, huh? Because you know, of course, that. The medezeggenschap now is often criticized, but yeah, students aren't interested, so the turnout is very low, 20% or 25%. Yes, so one reason it's far removed from the things you students are involved in, and also say professors and lecturers are involved in. You really have to study it and so on. So medezeggenschap in the current political climate, that we should have that, because you cannot just have kind of decisions at lower levels, but the basis should be smaller units. Not too small, because that then you get inbred and things like that, not too small, but say 50 to 100, or if... You can discuss that. Maybe, yeah. And of course, personally, I also have experienced really, total lack of having a voice and having a vote. This was at my university when they started to introduce het nieuwe werken, so this open office or flexible working, without any say of shop floor people. And even worse, so this was, implemented by appointing an interim manager, who, of course, for 6 months, and after 6 months, everybody hated her, of course, but then she went away. Huh? So this is, I think, common practice. Huh? But, so for me, this was quite an... I think a stimulus to continue working on these topics, huh? So that that you don't have an office. It's not just that you don't have an office. I don't have my working material with me. It's like natural sciences that you say you don't need laboratories. Everything is digital. Well, that's not the case. Okay, the second, from bureaucracy to substantive policy. Well, a crucial role for debate and arguments instead of top-down ukases and pompous rhetoric. So the slogans, born leaders reach for infinity. Also the free university looking further. I mean, how? I would like to know how much money they spent on this, looking further. Anyway, from commodification to public interest science. I will finish with a few more words about this, huh? Okay, science for economic development, there is nothing wrong with that. That should be part of it. But it should not have the primacy, huh? And it often has the primacy. For instance, have you looked at the Nationale Wetenschapsagenda? Huh? Look at the stuurgroep, so the steering committee. What you see in the steering committee, that, for instance, the employers are represented strongly. The unions are not represented in that. And so this whole steer group is really constituted very one-sidedly. So what, just one thing that should be formed in a much more balanced way. So okay, public interest has a normative component. It's not that you can, by empirical research, you can say, okay, yeah, now we know what is in the public interest. Huh? So because it's it is, say, for instance, the fighting poverty. That, well, you could say it's in the public interest, but then if you want to specify it, what does it mean? First, what does it mean to be poor? What does it mean to fight poverty? How could science play a role in fighting poverty? Then you will see that all kinds of also normative views will play a role in specifying, say, that we should fight poverty. So it means that, it requires some democratic debate, I think, there. Okay. Of course, there is a lot to say about that. Okay, now two important points concerning public interest science. So that's also about how science and how the public importance of science is being viewed from the outside. And so one thing is the common definition of knowledge use goes in terms of a target group and the needs of its users. This is extremely common. And you see it with NVO, you see it with KNAW, and the model is the medical model. You have a group of people who suffer from a specific disease, and you can describe that disease, and the group of people. And then you do public interest science, you come up with a solution for that, or at least you try that. And we should do that, of course. But this is, for the humanities and the social sciences, this is really one-sided. And also historians of science, they will think, well, we cannot cure cancer. That's impossible for us. So certainly in part, the social value of the humanities and social sciences is the creation of novel accounts of our big questions and of the conceptual and normative framework within which these questions can be legitimately phrased and discussed. And here I have two there are many more examples, but for instance, Michel Foucault, in the 1970s, he came up with a new theory of power. The theory of power is not as repressive, but as productive, as disciplining people, but still productive. Okay, we cannot discuss this here, but this was a rather new view on a very big issue. And it has resulted in a lot of debate, also in changes, and so on and so on. But it was not aimed at... Foucault didn't have a target group with the problem. Another example, Hannah Arendt. So in ethics, the notion of the banality of evil, have you heard about this? So she has this famous, or other people may think, infamous book about Nazi Germany. And so she said, yeah, this Eichmann, the administrator in the concentration camps, and he just did his duty. He was just a small cock in an administrative machine, and so on. And that she calls the banality of evil. And also this, I think, that was an important different insight. And again, there is no target group. There is no with a certain very specific problem. It's a very general view that so I would say here these views by Foucault and Arendt they should not be dismissed, certainly not, but you should also not be inflated into universal truths, because I think you can argue about it, but in spite of that they have put a new light on very big questions, good and evil, power and so on. So this means then that the valid critique of the dominant notion of public interest is itself a legitimate form of public interest science. So also philosophers, also media, people who work in media studies. In part, you are involved in these quite general projects. I'm not saying that we should stay only at a general level, but because, of course, then debate starts and you should specify it with Foucault, yeah, what kinds of disciplinary practices are there and how did they develop over time and so on and so on. But that doesn't do away with the fact that that this is a kind of public interest science that does not fit and is often left out from in the newspapers. It's very hard, if you write something like this, it's very hard to get it published in the Volkskrant. Maybe in the opinion, but not in the science, because this is outside of their framework. That's outside of their framework. So, okay. I think the final one. Two arguments for the public interest of basic research. So I think this is very important because these days, I think it's in the Netherlands, but it's in many other countries, that there is this enormous push for public interest science, and then with the immediate implication that is, of course, applied, very concrete research. And then they say, basic science or blue sky research is sometimes in English called. That is really not a good word. But that is under pressure these days. That's under pressure. Recently, I think, the VVD in the parliament, they had a new proposal that degree programs that are not very useful or not immediately useful, they should be stopped. So it's very important to discuss this and to see what kind of utility is meant if they say that this degree program is not very useful. So I really want to say that basic research constitutes an indispensable knowledge resource for the purpose of coping with the novel and complex problems that will face us in the future. My example is always, say, Islamic studies. Islamic studies in the 1970s. Okay, there were people who did this. For instance, in Leiden University, people who studied Arabic, the history of Arabic science and so on. These people did this. These days, they would have... suppose then that in the 1970s we already had this... this policy that, they are not very useful, so away with them. But what happens suddenly these days, if you're in do all kinds of Islamic studies, you can come to the television all the time. And so this is what I mean with you can generalize this for basic research. It's not that we have a guarantee that all basic research will be useful in unforeseeable circumstances. There is no guarantee. But I think it's the best thing we have because it creates, I call this a knowledge resource or maybe a knowledge infrastructure where you can use it to tackle, unexpected, unanticipated problems in the future. The problems you don't know at the moment. And I think this you can substantiate this argument by looking at the history of science. Also, there no guarantee, but it happened often enough that things that were not were just basic science. That, for instance, our colleague here, Dennis Dix, he is in you know him maybe. He was a professor of foundations of physics. He did some work. He taught this. He did some work in the interpretation of quantum mechanics. That was really a field that was the VVD wouldn't like that. That was really useless. Useless. You cannot do anything. What happened? He published a paper, I think, 15 years ago, and that paper at first nothing happened with it, but suddenly people started to talk about quantum computation and quantum computers. And he had proved a theorem in that paper that was useful in thinking about quantum computers. Okay, it's just one example, but there are many more. Okay, and then finally, teaching and learning basic research should include systematic reflection on the nature of science and its role in society. Under these conditions, it will provide society not only with expert researchers, but also with critical and responsible citizens. And there's also you as students, it's not, probably not all of you will continue in research, but the idea is that you meet broad problems, you learn say a certain attitude of studying those, of approaching those, of writing about those, discussing those, and so on. And so something like Bildung, that's what I mean with the past thing. But yeah, the Bildung is sometimes used in a fully individualized way. And I think that is also important, but here I had arguments for the public interest of basic research. So. Well, that's it. So, thank you.
Thanks for sticking with us till the very end. We hope our initiative will be repeated with other guests next year. Meanwhile, please visit De Omslag for more interesting articles on the public perception of science. The link, once again, is in the podcast description. Until then, happy perceptions!